Welcome to the Ogletree Deacons Podcast, a brief discussion of compelling legal issues and practical insights. Please note that the information in this podcast is for informational purposes only and is not intended to be, nor should it be construed as legal advice. You can subscribe to this podcast on Apple Podcasts or through your favorite podcast service. Please consider rating and reviewing so that we may continue to provide the content that covers your needs. Please enjoy the program.
Welcome to the Cross-Border Catch-Up, the podcast for global employers who want to stay in the know about cutting-edge employment issues worldwide. My name is Diana, and I head up the cross-border practice here at Ogletree. I am based in Stamford, Connecticut, and I'm here with my colleague, Patty Shapiro, who's also a member of the cross-border team and is based in San Diego. Today, we're going to discuss the very interesting topic of employment considerations in global acquisitions. We often find that the employment issues are the last to be considered when a company is acquiring another or divesting itself of an entity to another. And that can create unexpected costs and hurdles that the business side of the house is not always taking into account when they're negotiating the terms and the transaction price. So it's going to be an interesting one today. I'm going to ask Patty some questions, and she has quite a bit of experience with this and has some really interesting perspectives. So Patty, where do you start, right? Like you, and I think with the premise basically that by the time we get involved, we being the labor and employment attorneys, is already out of the barn. The purchase agreement, if not already signed, is pretty darn close. And we're probably just looking at the disclosures and reps and warranties with our fingers crossed, not necessarily having had a chance to partake in any significant undertaking of understanding the facts in play and the employment issues at play. So once we're through that and we're on board, what is step one?
Step one, yeah, I think employment considerations unfortunately kind of fall to the wayside in these conversations and considerations when doing a global acquisition, but they really shouldn't because they really influence the timeline and could affect the purchase price. So step one, when you're looking at a target, let's find out who the employees are. I think that that's something that often gets overlooked, unfortunately, lots of companies use independent contractors or contingent workers, those people that are employed through a third party, like an employer of record. And those kinds of relationships compared to an employee, a direct employee that you have an employment agreement with, warrant different considerations and different steps in an acquisition or a transfer of employees. So that's definitely step one, is let's figure out the makeup of the workforce and what it includes.
Yeah, definitely the makeup and where are the individuals located, right? Because every country's law is going to have a different take on employment relationship issues, on IP issues, and then on misclassification issues, all sorts of things. So I think, yeah, you definitely, the first thing you should be asking for is a list, is a census effectively, right? Like a list of locations, employees at each location, and other types of engagements of personnel at other locations. I think that's absolutely right.
Exactly. And if they do have independent contractors, for example, I think a lot of companies, unfortunately, when they use independent contractors internationally, they don't scrutinize the relationship, perhaps just because they're unaware of the classification issues, or they're the same that they are here in the US generally. But I think that's often overlooked because it's an easy way to engage people. To the extent you're acquiring a company that has a lot of entities across the world and may be engaging a large population of independent contractors, it's prudent to look at whether those independent contractors are potentially misclassified employees, especially if they've been on for a long time and may have employment claims that could be a big liability for the acquiring company if a claim were to come up after the deal closes.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think, you know, it's funny about global independent contractors. I mean, we all know the risk of misclassification in the US. You know, it's pretty much the same outside the US, except sort of on steroids for reasons that we'll talk about in another podcast. But I think because the folks are overseas that they're engaging, it almost doesn't feel real to companies. Like it's like some person in Serbia who's an incredible software developer, you know, but the company's not in Serbia, the person's very far away. Like it almost doesn't feel like a tangible risk because it's not like having an independent contractor who comes to the work site every day as they would perhaps in the United States, which would really make them tangible and the risk associated would be tangible. And I think we are seeing, Serbia was not a random country thrown out for no reason. We are seeing a ton of tech developers, software developers, just a ton of tech talent in very interesting jurisdictions, like very, very much so in Eastern European countries. We have seen a lot, quite a bit in Serbia, Ukraine, even despite the war.
Yeah, exactly.
It keeps popping up, as well as in South America. Obviously, the cost of engaging contractors in those jurisdictions is far lower, so there is often cost factors driving it. But I'm focusing on software developers only because usually you hire them because you want them to make the things that make the company run, right? And are probably creating your source code. And so as part of that analysis, when you're looking at these contractors, I'd want to know if any are creating such source code and then figure out how I'm going to own it. Because the problem is that while we may have default rules on assignment of IP rights to contract from contractors to the company or even employees to the company, other countries don't. And particularly in the employment sphere, so you worry, and it is a possible risk, that if the person that you've engaged as a contractor is creating source code, you go to enforce your rights. And where are you enforcing them, by the way? Like, you're probably not going to go to Serbia, but you're right. Not going to bring the person here. And then in countries like Argentina, which is another hotspot for software development, like if you engage an individual as a contractor and then go to enforce your rights, you know, if I were them, I would turn around and say, no, sorry, I was an employee all this time. And that matters not just for all the other misclassification issues we talk about, but it matters because in Argentina in particular, you have to have very specific language in the employment contract, and it has to be structured in a very certain way so that the employer owns the IP. And so, you know, it's a little theoretical. It's a little, you know, heaven.
Well, yes and no. I mean, in some countries, you even need to have additional consideration for the assignment of those IP rights. So if your target doesn't own the IP, then you're certainly not going to own the IP. So I think the IP piece is pretty critical for both independent contractors, and that's a great segue actually into contingent workers. Yep. Oftentimes, the service agreement between a service recipient of EOR services and the EOR may not eloquently address the issue of IP rights, and maybe even the employment agreement between the contingent worker and the EOR does not dial in. I've actually seen this recently in Italy where it did not adequately or appropriately address the assignment of IP rights from the contingent worker to the EOR. So they didn't even own those rights, and then therefore couldn't transfer them to the service recipient. And it was pretty critical IP producer. So it's something that comes up a surprising amount.
Absolutely, especially as the world gets more global and these sources of talent in other jurisdictions become more and more prevalent and well-known. Definitely. Okay, so we've gotten through that. We've taken a look at the census. We have a general sense of how folks are engaged, you know, whether they're contingent workers, contractors, regular old employees that the company is, the target's engaging directly. What would you do next once you've sorted all that out?
So next, I would look at the target's employment practices and procedures and see if they have their house in order or what kind of potential mess are you inheriting. For example, do they have employment agreements with their direct employees? Are those compliant with what the law requires? I've seen a lot of countries recently, like Japan and Portugal, implement a lot of new requirements for information that has to be in a fixed term employment agreement or just an employment agreement generally. And so if the target has not been staying abreast of that, perhaps they don't have employment contracts that are legally adequate. Also, outside of the US, there are lots of working time regulations and overtime regulations that are more expansive than they are here in the US. We're really used to, I think, like a 50-50 of exempt versus non-exempt employees. And so common, the clients that we interact with anyway, have a lot of exempt employees. So they don't think about things like overtime. But outside of the US, it's a much higher threshold generally to be exempt from overtime. So if the target doesn't have a timekeeping process, then potentially you have exposure for unpaid overtime. Or if they attempted to contract out of overtime liability, but the country doesn't allow you to do that, you kind of have that exposure hanging out there too. And with the record keeping, there's also oftentimes companies outside of the US don't always have a good practice for keeping track of annual leave, which becomes an issue when you have to pay it out at the end of the employment relationship if you can't go back and understand when they took leave and how that affected their bank and then what's due. So you could potentially have to pay more than you otherwise would.
Right. I mean, if you don't have any, if you're in a country that doesn't allow use it or lose it, right? And people just continue to accrue and carry over. I mean, it can be a tremendous amount of money. And in some countries, it's tricky for how you, I'm thinking of Brazil in particular, like you some of it you can sort of cash out, the employee can sort of like, you basically buy back the employee's vacation days, but that's only with respect to a certain percentage. And in some countries, you actually can't buy it back at all. And then you have to like allow them to take the year of leave they've accrued. So it's really, really important that you take a look at that.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And then also understanding if they have a works council in place or workers' representatives or a union. And then is there a collective bargaining agreement that goes with that? Do they have the appropriate policies and procedures with respect to that workers' representative organization, or the required policies just generally for the organization? And I think the Works Council piece is critically important in an acquisition, because as you'll see in a second, that influences the protocol and the steps required to transfer employees from the target to the acquiring company.
Yep, that makes total sense. That makes total sense. Yeah, all of that can be very, very expensive. And so it's very important to put together, be sure you have an excellent due diligence checklist, and you're going in and you're basically running an audit of the existing employment practices to figure out how much exposure there is. And again, like there, you know, typically the threshold for materiality is pretty high in these kind of transactions, and usually you don't get there with employment matters. But if you find widespread, massive misclassification and, you know, not using vacation, it could become quite costly, such that it could certainly get close to being an issue for materiality. So,
and it's not uncommon, I'd say, these days, in the last few years, since a lot of companies have started recruiting kind of without borders anywhere in the world, engaging people anywhere in the world. I think there are, unfortunately, a lot of companies that do have widespread misclassification. Like everybody they engage outside of the U.S. is an independent contractor.
Yeah.
Not really. Can create a significant exposure. But to your point, you know, maybe it doesn't tip the scales from a materiality perspective, but definitely something to keep on the radar and not overlook and only to find out and be disappointed.
Oh,
about.
Yeah. I'm just 100% agreed. Like, I would not assume that it doesn't impact materiality. I think that's exactly right. I mean, I think the notion that, that because historically, typically, in a lot, you know, in the transactional world, it hasn't always been the most important point, doesn't mean it's not a really important point that could have an impact. And I think that's exactly the thing. I think it's easy to sort of snooze on, you know, hit the snooze button on the employment issues and sort of like leave it to the end when you finally are ready to get out of bed. And then you find that you have like a disaster on your hands. So I think early and often intervention, review, that kind of stuff is critical for sure.
Exactly. Exactly.
For sure. All right. So once we've done that, we've gone through, you know, assessing what kind of situation they are, the target has with respect to employment practices. You know, you're in the, you had, so you signed the purchase agreement, deal hasn't closed yet. So before you get to close, how do you build a timeline?
Yeah, so the most important piece is to look at what kind of deal it's going to be. So if we have a share sale, there's not a ton of considerations. It may vary country to country, but overall, you're just acquiring all of the equity in a company. An employer is not actually changing. And so from an employment law perspective, there aren't necessarily a lot of hoops. But if it's an asset sale, it's a very different situation. Lots of countries have what's called a transfer of undertakings protection of employment legislation, often referred to as TUPE, or an acquired rights directive, which serves the same purpose, basically to protect the target employee's employment in the event of an acquisition. And those regulations have a ton of requirements and can be very expansive depending on the country. So, for example, advance notice, there's a whole inform and consult procedure. Advance notice is basically the crux of it all. And it could be 30 days, but it could be 3 months. It just depends on the country and whether you have a works council and all of the nuances there. The notice itself also is not always very high level. Some countries require it to actually include like the reason for the acquisition and the transfer and the potential consequences to the employees. There shouldn't be a change in their terms and conditions of employment. That's part of the legislation, is to keep that all the same. But to the extent that there are going to be other consequences, economic or otherwise, to the employees, you would have to notify them in advance. there could also be collective bargaining agreements that impose even more requirements on top of the 2P acquired rights directive or similar legislation.
Yeah, I think that's fair. And I think even with a stock sale, you're right, the employer is not changing. The employer remains the same. It's the same entity, but it is a new shareholder that ultimately owns it. And even though that doesn't trigger 2P necessarily, you still may, with the Works Council, need to inform and consult on that and get their approval, sure, depending on the relationship. I mean, again, I know I leave the Works Council stuff to our incredible colleagues in Europe. They are amazing. But the issue is that even if there's not a specific requirement, you have to keep that relationship strong, right? Like, that is so important to manage because they have a lot of power in many countries.
Exactly. So once you're looking at all of these different considerations and where you may have to inform and consent and what the requirements are or what just makes sense to keep relations good with the workforce, all of that will help inform a reasonable timeline. So, which could again be very short, maybe a month or so, or it could be much longer. But I think some companies I've seen expect it to be, or hope it to be, a quick turnaround, a couple of weeks or so. And unfortunately, globally, that's generally not realistic.
It definitely can take much longer than we're used to it taking in the US, for sure.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Okay. So basically, we've gone through confirming the house is in order or not, and understanding where the exposure is there. You know, what's the fourth step? What do we do next? Where do we sort of land before we've done our complete, as much as we can do from a preparation perspective?
So for some companies, it may stop at that point. So you have the employees of the target come over on their same terms and conditions. There aren't any changes. You're keeping everybody. So you kind of just carry on employing them pursuant to the applicable employment law. A lot of companies that we deal with in acquisitions do want to make some changes. So maybe they want to change the terms and conditions of each individual's employment, or, you know, the benefits that they offer. Or maybe they don't want to keep everybody and there are some people that they want to lay off in this process. And that gets a bit tricky. So from a changing the terms and conditions perspective specifically, you can always give people more, right? That's, the law is never concerned about giving them more than they otherwise had. But if you want to change something detrimental to an employee, then generally speaking, it will require their consent. And if they don't consent, then it simply does not apply. They would continue to be entitled to whatever they were previously. And from a layoff perspective, to the extent that companies don't want to bring everybody over, there could be other considerations. So maybe it's an individual redundancy, meaning there's an economic reason or there's not going to be that position anymore under the new model or after the acquisition. But if there are a lot of people that are not coming over, you could trigger collective redundancy requirements, which may have its own notice and inform and consult procedure, just to make this all so much longer. And there are oftentimes in a 2B situation where the employees may actually be protected from being terminated for a specific period, maybe a year. That could also be in a collective bargaining agreement, or even perhaps as a condition of the sale that some or all of the employees cannot be let go. So to the extent that a company wants to not take everybody, there are some additional details that have to be fleshed out. And in addition to those, in some countries, just for any sort of termination, whether we're talking about in connection with a acquisition or not, there are protected employees that cannot be terminated, which is something different than we're used to here in the US. So for example, I think Brazil is a great example of this because it's so unusual. Yes. So any pregnant employee cannot be terminated, but it's not just during the period that they're pregnant and then out on maternity leave. And then there's a period after that, that's called a stability period, where they still can't be terminated once they return. And what's really interesting about Brazil is that it's not just if they're pregnant and they've told you that they're pregnant. It's if they know they're pregnant and haven't told you, or even if they don't know that they're pregnant and they find out later, it can really cause some unique issues and be an obstacle to termination.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Oh man, there is a lot. I feel like we could do literally probably a day session on these issues. There's so much to talk about in this context. So yeah, thank you so much for joining us for today's cross-border catch-up. Follow us to stay in the know about cutting-edge employment issues worldwide.
Thank you for joining us on the Ogletree Deacons podcast. You can subscribe to our podcasts on Apple Podcasts or through your favorite podcast service. Please consider rating and reviewing so that we may continue to provide the content that covers your needs. And remember, the information in this podcast is for informational purposes only and is not to be construed as legal advice.